Welcome to Trending in Education. Mike Palmer here. Really excited today to be joined by Dr. Ken Carter, who is doing some interesting work. He's classically trained in the field of psychology, and he's also been doing really interesting work around public scholarship. He's starting a center now at Emory University. Rather than me talk about it, I'd rather hear from Ken. Ken, welcome to Trending in Education.
Yeah, great to see you. Yeah, I'm super excited about what we're doing here at Emory. I'm now the founding director of our Center for Public Scholarship and Engagement, and I'm happy to talk about that. And also happy to talk about the other things I've been doing in psychology and in public scholarship as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have a really interesting trajectory. What I love about what you're doing is it has some crossover appeal. Some of your stuff appears on like regular broadcast journalistic endeavors. So there is a nice crossover potential there, which sounds very much tied to what you're doing at Emory now. We always like to start by getting to know our guests a little better, and I think it all ties together in a nice narrative bow to some extent. Can you catch us up a little bit on your background and how you got to this point in your professional life?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I've actually only ever wanted to be maybe three different things in my life. Back when I was a kid, I wanted to be a disc jockey or a television, you know, anchor on TV. And wasn't really great at public speaking as a little kid, so I thought I can't do that. Later, I thought I wanted to be a scientist, and I read that scientists had to learn Latin, so I decided I'm not going to be a scientist. And then I actually became a scientist. I became a psychologist in fifth grade. The World Book Encyclopedia said that the psychologists were really good at listening to people. Mm-hmm. My friends told me I was a good listener, and so I decided to be a psychologist. Not a lot of people get to do the same thing that they thought they wanted to do in fifth grade and still really enjoy it.
Right. And then that field is really broad when you talk about psychology, but you've specialized in some interesting areas.
Yeah. So my PhD is in clinical psychology. I also have a second master's in psychopharmacology, which has to do with medications. Mm-hmm. But I'm also at Emory, I teach a lot of introductory classes, so foundational classes in psychology. And so I consider myself a generalist. And because of that, and teaching so many first and second year students here at Oxford College, I've learned to translate really complicated, fairly boring stuff into everyday language. And because of that, I also have done some fun work translating the psychology of thrill seeking, which can be very complicated, into everyday language as well.
Exactly. You had me at the extreme sports angle, which we'll dig into as much as we can. But also the problem space you're talking about here, you were kind of touching on there too, where the problem that academia has, that higher ed has frequently, is that, you know, the whole ivory tower critique where you're just talking amongst yourselves and you're not really engaging the rest of the world in a lot of the research and insights and perspective you really have to bear. Can you talk a little more about the center that you're launching at Emory, the problem space it's working on and what you're hoping to do there?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Academics are really, really good at talking to each other and not that great about talking to the public or knowing how to do that. Mm-hmm. I've always felt like there's a lot of amazing, interesting stuff that's sort of trapped in journals and academic books. Yeah. You know, back when I decided to write the book called Buzz, a lot of those things on thrill seekers were only in academic books. Right. And finding a way to translate that, I thought, was very important. So I talked with my provost about launching this new center that helps sort of connect scholars and the public to each other.
Yeah.
And right now we've got two big initiatives that we're working on. One is an ideas festival that we're going to have here that really is going to be a buffet of ideas for the public, 44 different events over a three-day period in all different areas that you might encounter, including food and civil discourse, psychology, science. We have a children's stage. Really sort of bringing the public onto campus to learn about some of the things that we do in a really engaging, fun way. So that's the first piece of what we're up to.
Yeah.
The second piece is a public scholarship academy for academics. Mm. And this will be a conference that different academics can come to from all areas of the academic sphere to learn about how to be better at engaging the public. Mm. We'll have classes on podcasting. We'll have classes on media training, you know, sort of storytelling to make sure that we can bring that out into the world.
Right. It's exciting stuff. We'll be sharing the information. There is a website?
Yeah, publicscholarship.emory.edu.
Amazing. And we'll include that in the show notes for the episode. That all being said, we did want to tap into some of your expertise as a psychologist. It's certainly a time where psychology is certainly front and center on a number of dimensions, whether it's in the political realm or in the personal realm, social media and artificial intelligence, how it's impacting on our identity formation and mental health. There's so many ways to go at this, but you certainly landed in an interesting place in terms of relevance as someone who studied psychology. Anything top of mind, anything emerging for an audience who's trying to understand where the world of learning's going? You know, you think about that, but you also are tapped into what's happening in psychology specifically. Anything top level trend-wise that's resonating for you these days?
Yeah, I mean, two things are sort of buzzing around in my head in terms of loneliness and the epidemic of loneliness that people have been talking about, how to help people to be able to have high quality social contacts without really being pulled away by social media or the distractions of busyness in general. Yeah. And so that's definitely been top of mind to me about what we can do to help with that and to increase our hardiness around the things that are happening to us.
Right.
The second piece is really, you know, AI, right? That's sort of, I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to navigate that as an educator, you know, how I can use it as a tool in my classes rather than thinking about it as a sort of a moral threat in my classes. And so trying to integrate that in a way that it can be helpful, but also knowing that it's sort of here to stay.
Right.
And so, yeah, those are the two things that have been sort of buzzing around in my head in terms of psychology.
Yeah. And they're both interesting on multiple dimensions. But then the impact of artificial intelligence on our psychology is the thing that I've been struck by, where, you know, this idea of technology as other is something that's kind of always been there. But now that other is starting to rival our intelligence. It was one thing when you could almost externalize lower level tasks and automate that. That was fine. But now it does feel like it's more of a like fundamental identity risk, I guess, is the way I would kind of see it, where like suddenly things that we thought were uniquely human are now being externalized and powered by technology. How does that manifest, you know, I guess for normal folks? And then I imagine it's also got to be a really tough time if I was clinically paranoid. There's a lot more stuff that is genuinely paranoia inducing nowadays. Yeah. So I'd love to get a little bit of your take on that.
Yeah, for me personally, I've sort of leaned into it as a great brainstorming tool, you know, and so, you know, using ChatGPT, for example, to help me figure out tough situations. I ask it to imagine it has a certain kind of knowledge of, in terms of the kinds of therapists that I know. And then I use it to brainstorm. And so sometimes when I'm feeling stuck, it can help get me unstuck. But I think it really has to do, like every tool, like how you use it is really important.
Right.
But I also know that a lot of publishers are really nervous about sort of uploading tons of things into it. You know, I don't want to upload my whole book into it because I'm not sure what it will do with it.
Right.
And so I can see that being a big issue for some people as well.
Right, right. And then I think there's also, you know, how will therapy evolve? How will clinical interventions evolve? You know, we always talk about the future of work. I would envision a lot of the therapeutic dynamics to be somewhat future-proof. It'll be tough to replace the entirety of that with a bot, but I'm sure that research is already underway. You know, any thoughts on that, where like the future of therapy, robotherapy, teletherapy?
Yeah.
You know, technology is certainly influencing your field.
Yeah, especially in areas like cognitive behavioral therapy, there are a lot of manualized treatments already. There are a lot of great apps that can help people with insomnia or think through depression or anxiety.
It kind of even dates back to ELISA, right? ELISA was, back in the day, was like a pretty rudimentary form of artificial intelligence that would perform the role of a therapist. This is back in like the 70s, I think, right?
Yeah, and ELISA was, I think, really trying to emulate a humanistic therapist in a mostly annoying way.
Yes.
And so I do remember ELISA. And so this is sort of a different version of it. The other thing that sort of worries me, too, is that, you know, these large language models that they're using to do these things are, there may be some biases sort of built into that. So I do worry about relying too heavily on that without some sort of human tweaking to it. But I can't imagine, you know, again, it's helped me sort of think through some things, brainstorm some things. But I also know what I'm looking for. Like, I know what to ask it. And so I think, you know, again, this is early days for that. So I don't think we're far away from being able to, you know, have it help us with those everyday struggles and sort of doubts that we all have. Yeah. But I hope it will also be there to help us know when we need to reach out to a professional for advice.
The interesting questions for me around clinical cases and psychology is more that blend of, you know, you got to imagine some of the bots and some of the large language models should open up access to like 24/7 access and like some light level of engagement that, you know, it may help people. Like I have seen some research talking about how, you know, even for attendance and avoiding melt among students, that if they are getting regular texts from even an avatar that they know isn't human, they still feel accounted for and someone's kind of checking on them. And that's something that can kind of really build a safety net. But that's where the human in the loop part of the recipe is the part that I think is going to be really interesting to watch within psychology. The other dimension I've seen is leveraging peer-to-peer more as almost like there's the bot level, then there's the peer-to-peer level, and then there's more at the trained professional level, because there's a real shortage of trained mental health professionals nowadays as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of that's due to the shift that we've had in terms of understanding how that mental health care can be helpful for people. But also during COVID, we all got introduced to being able to do therapy remotely, right?
Right.
And not being, you know, face to face. Many states, I think it's 40 or so different states, allow psychologists to practice across state lines using telehealth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's changed things as well. So it used to be 5 years ago, I'd rarely have a student in one of my classes sort of talk about their own mental health or their work with a therapist.
Right.
Now, a week can't go by without someone talking about it. And I think that's a really great thing.
Yep.
It is creating a bit of a demand and strain on the industry currently.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have more students than ever who are interested in going into mental health. And so I see a bright future in that.
Yeah. And it's interesting, the app, for those who are watching, I'm picking up my phone, the idea that mental health is now in your pocket, you know, access to a therapist is right there. The apps are great, but at the same time, this device and the apps on it is also contributing to my lack of mental health.
Right.
It's a slippery slope when it comes to some of this stuff. How about that element? I imagine would also be part of the public engagement and public scholarship that you're looking for. One of the topics, in addition to being a little disconcerted and, you know, unclear, fearful around artificial intelligence, there's also an increasing awareness that mental health, and particularly the mental health of our youth, has been damaged by some of the apps. You know, there were congressional hearings recently with, you know, Facebook, TikTok, a lot of the social media platforms that were pretty tough, you know, basically saying, you know, what have you done to some extent? What are your thoughts on that? I imagine there's a whole wealth of research that's happening in this space.
Yeah. And so it's really interesting. Back when I was revising the beginnings of my introductory psychology textbook, I realized that my generation, I'm a Gen Xer, has a very different view of the world than my students who are more Gen Z. Mm-hmm. So I started sort of taking a dive into some of the information about that, but also just talking with my students about their experience of the world, feeling like I was sort of teaching to what I thought was a younger version of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And now I know I am not teaching to a younger version of myself.
Yeah.
Back when I was in school, when I left high school to go to college, I didn't see my friends anymore. You know, I saw them when I went home for the holidays,
right,
or I might write them a letter.
Yes.
But now the students have to maintain those social connections with pretty much everyone they've ever met, plus a whole bunch of people that they've never met as well.
Yeah.
So the fracturing of those social connections that feel like they are the same as everyday in-person connections creates a strain in terms of being able to maintain those.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I know that students feel like people are presenting a different version of themselves online.
Mm-hmm.
So the authenticity of those relationships also feel disconnected as well.
Yeah.
So I can see how that can really create some struggle in terms of real high quality connections with people.
Yeah. And then you mentioned that, you know, the loneliness problem and the lack of those deeper connections and sort of the social fabric that feels like it's breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see interventions that are kind of moving the needle in the other direction?
Yeah, absolutely. Here at Emory, we're doing some large scale programs with students, really focusing on that resilience piece, talking about failure and the importance of failure. I think because of the sort of curated world that we see through social media,
yeah,
where everything's a success and everything is the most amazing vacation ever, and every meal is Instagrammable, to get into the actual world that's not Instagrammable can feel a little bit of a letdown if you feel like everyone else is doing these amazing things. And so yeah, we've been doing some things around what we call the Purpose Project, which helps students to think about what their purpose might be, but also what their life after college may be like. So I was involved in a campaign where faculty and staff were talking about sort of big failures that they've had and how they were actually navigated them. Normalizing those kinds of discussions, I think, can be very important for students, but also important for people. I think we celebrate success, but we don't really celebrate failure in the way that we should.
Yeah. And that's where I always quote Nelson Mandela, "I never lose, I either win or learn." You know, like the actual yes. learning opportunities is when there's a disconnect from your worldview and then reality. And for those of us who are able to learn, we're able to adjust. And then it is a different level of vulnerability from folks in a position of authority, position of leadership, to kind of model that. And right. and maybe that does tie a bit to the work you're doing at the center, where what are some of the challenges in terms of, I guess, even the psychology of scholars that may make it harder for them to kind of break through when trying to engage with the public?
There's a lot of fear, I think, involved for faculty, and the fear around being sort of misunderstood or making it too simple. You know, this is your life's passion, and to be able to talk about it in a couple of sound bites never feels like you're doing it justice.
Yeah.
But also sort of understanding that there's something that the everyday person can gain from what you're doing, which is the thing that makes it so exciting for me. The fact that, you know, I can have my students in front of me that are learning something, I hope, from their interactions with me, or I can have the world as my classroom, where I'm giving some information that I'm hoping is helping somebody out there. To me, there's a connection, especially in psychology, with therapy and teaching, and to me, doing public scholarship and teaching as well.
Yeah.
And so that's why I've always really enjoyed it.
How does media connect to all this? Because it does seem like we are in a, I don't even know what generation of wave we are in media revolutions, but it does feel like we're in an entirely different phase. Even the level to which folks are talking about artificial intelligence in formats like this feels unprecedented to me. It does feel like a bit of an intellectual renaissance where like people are really getting into it. In this misinformation and confusing crisis of trust, we do need people who can kind of find the signal in the noise. How are you thinking about that? How are you thinking about using media, training folks on media? Any thoughts on just how the landscape is pretty crazy nowadays?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pieces to that. I mean, I'm thinking back to myself as a little kid wanting to be a news anchor. And in order to get the news story out there, you'd have to be on one of the four channels that are on television, right? And that was all there was.
Right.
And now you can have your own channel. Right. You can have your own way to broadcast that out there.
Mm-hmm.
A faculty member came to me last year and said, "Hey, I want to do this thing and I want it to be on television." I'm like, "You've got a phone. you can go out into the world and in a different way." And so I think the accessibility of that, I think, is more than we've ever had before.
Yeah.
But the noise is also out there more than before, because everybody has a phone, right?
Right.
And so how to get out there in a way where you're relevant, but also interesting enough to be able to get that message across and to be a trusted voice in that way.
Yeah. And it is another one where, you know, the old saw, the perfect is the enemy of the good, where what I find as a podcaster who ships a lot of episodes, very few of them are perfect, Ken. I'll share that with you. But they're good, and they're good that they get out there. And I think there is that, you're almost trained in the opposite direction as an academic, where you have to defend and go through revisions and make that journal article and make your dissertation perfect and then be able to answer every question. And then once that's done, this feels like a very different exercise to engage, where in some ways signaling where you don't know the answer and where you do is almost more being able to discern between where my expertise is truly giving me something unique to offer and where almost disarming the audience by saying, I'm no different than you. I'm as lost as you might be.
Yeah. And to me, it's about curiosity, right? Mm. And engaging your curiosity to try to figure out what you want to know, but also engaging the audience's curiosity as well. So mm-hmm. I'm excited about bringing faculty. And since I also do continuing education workshops for therapists, I've had a lot of therapists come to me and say, hey, I want to in on that too. I have something to say that I think that might be helpful to the community. I want to learn how to, you know, go through media training or how to start a podcast or how to turn this journal article into a comic book, you know? And so I feel like there's a lot of, we think of stuff that scholars do as being in that ivory tower, but to me, I want it to be a first floor kind of experience for people.
That's interesting too, because one of the things I've been talking about in light of the generative tools that are out there is that our floors are all being raised because we can all generate much better, higher level stuff with less effort. And frequently the problem is finding the expertise where the expertise is frequently inherent in the scholars. That's sort of the whole nature of the beast. We're getting closer to time. We haven't talked about lessons learned from extreme sports. I wouldn't do my listeners justice if we didn't get a little bit into that. Any high level ideas or thoughts? We'll also include a link to your book in the show notes. Any stuff from that perspective you think might be useful for folks in this day and age?
Yeah, I feel like the number one lesson I feel like I learned from a lot of those extreme sports thrill seeker people, you know, is to trust yourself, you know? And so I think, you know, the psychology of the sort of the way that they're built, they trust their bodies to know exactly what to do in those situations. There's some chemicals that help power that. But I think for me as a non-thrill seeker, I should trust myself a little bit more as well. And this sort of goes back along with sort of trusting in terms of getting out into the public to be able to communicate those messages. That is probably going to work out, you know? Yeah. And so I think that's my lesson from that from today.
Yeah, it reminds me also of the learning science idea, the psychology idea, really, of desirable difficulty, productive struggle. Like the idea that you need enough resistance and enough challenge, enough discomfort to make it meaningful to win. Yeah. But also not so challenging and so discouraging that you wind up, you know, like Seligman's dogs, you wind up depressed because you can't actually get through. Been an amazing conversation. I'm talking to Ken Carter. We'll include links to the work he's doing at Emory, where they're opening a center for public scholarship. We'll include links to that and also to his book on extreme sports. Ken, as we're wrapping up, concluding thoughts, takeaways for our listeners as they head back to their lives?
Yeah, I think to me, it's all about curiosity and awe, right? Finding those things that make the world an interesting place for you, whether it's in the classroom, whether it's, you know, on the ski slopes, or whether it's learning something new that you think is really cool. These are all just ways to feed our curiosity and empower our awe.
Amazing stuff. With Dr. Ken Carter out of Emory University, we'll be including links to everything Ken was talking about in the show notes for the episode. Ken, thanks again for joining me on today's episode.
It's been great. Thanks.
And for our listeners, hopefully you enjoyed what you heard. If you did, please subscribe, tell your friends, do all the good things. We'll be back again soon. This is Trending in Education.